Digital Foundry Business and Software Consulting is proud to support its multinational clientele and the California Report podcast, Digital Foundry, on the web at digitalfoundry.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, if you've got $10 million burning a hole in your wallet, have we got a deal for you? How would you like to own a private island in San Francisco Bay? We'll take you there. And environmental activists skirting the law. They're gray water gorillas putting secondhand water to good use.
Doesn't make a lot of sense to have to pay a lot of fees and spend days to try to get the right permits to just detach your sink and send it outside to water your plants. So you don't want to drink gray water, definitely, but it's not that dirty, and your plants love it.
Also, mandatory water rationing in two California counties. Could dry weather, a thirsty population, and a tiny little fish in the Sacramento Delta mean the worst of the water shortage is yet to come? I'm Scott Schaefer. Those stories plus tofu making as the family business, next on the California Report. When I was a kid growing up back east, summer and water went hand in hand. June through August was all about swimming pools, beaches, watermelons, squirt guns, and water balloons. And so today, we're putting a California twist on a summertime water theme with stories about the drought, a tofu maker, and renegade plumbers. And we begin with a little piece of real estate surrounded by water that could be yours for the right price. Interested? Dave Glickman is your man. He's a co-owner of Red Rock Island, the only privately held island in San Francisco Bay.
I was always attracted by the more unusual properties, maybe a problem property that by using some imagination, you could make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
Glickman is an attorney and a former gem dealer. He bought the island in 1964 for less than $50,000. Now, at age 78, he's living in Asia and hoping to cash out the island to help finance his retirement. Talking with us by phone from Thailand, he claims to realize that this is not your typical real estate listing.
Most island buyers think of a tropical island with palm trees. So it's not the traditional island buyer that would buy it.
The bigger question may be, will anyone buy it? Glickman put Red Rock Island on the market a few years ago. Asking price, $10 million. Number of offers, zero. Well, he's going to try it again. So we thought, let's go check it out. The environmental group Baykeeper offered me, my producer, and our photographer a ride to the island on their 26-foot catamaran. Ed Essick is the skipper.
We're about to go to Red Rock Island, which is just off the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, and we'll be going probably just east of Alcatraz and straight over to Red Rock.
Wait a minute. Five passengers, a short ride on a small boat to an island, a skipper. Well, there's no professor and no one named Ginger or Marianne. Still, I couldn't get the Gilligan's Island theme song out of my head.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship.
Well, maybe there is a professor after all. Deb Self, Baykeeper's executive director. She has more than a passing interest in Red Rock Island.
And it's a major corridor for migrating fish and home to a lot of birds and close to some important seal workeries and also is home to a fair-sized population of black-crested night herons.
And it has really nice views. Just ask Stephen Higby. He's the realtor for this six-acre rock, and he's working on his sales pitch.
People have talked about, like, wouldn't it make a great casino or a lavish hotel or something? This is certainly enough rock on here. You could make your own breakwater and harbor and still have plenty of island for the building or something. So I guess one is limited by their imagination and the permit process.
Ah, the permit process. More on that later. First, we've got an island to explore. All right, Stephen, here it is, your latest listing.
Right.
Soon to be.
Really healthy-looking poison oak.
Yeah, good thing we got long pants, huh?
That and ceanothus.
Red Rock Island is, well, red and rocky. And that's about it. No dock, No marina, no buildings, no roads. Just rock, poison oak, a few rabbits, and birds. Lots and lots of birds.
I got to tell you, the birds have been following us around the island since we got here. I would imagine they're not used to seeing people walking around on this island. And you have to wonder how they would take to somebody living here.
This is the first time Higby has set foot on this island he's trying to sell. See, he doesn't have a boat. But the guy likes an adventure, and he wants to climb to the top of this island. He hears there's a rope here, somewhere, to help scale the island with, but he can't find it. So he does what you or I would do. He gets out his cell phone and calls Mona Derning, who knows Dave Glickman and the other owner of this island.
Hey, Mona, Stephen Higby. I'm standing on Red Rock Island. I am. And, well, we came out here. I'm out here with Scott Schaefer from KQED. And where did you tell me the rope was? Which side?
You say road or rope?
Rope, as in a line, a hand line.
So Steve is scaling the side of this mountain so he can take some photographs. And I got to tell you, it does not look safe. And I'm not going up there.
A half hour or more later, Higby is back on the shore. His shirt is a little bloody, and the seat of his pants are filthy. He slid down the hill. So, now that he's got a better sense of this property he's trying to sell, what does he think?
A guy I love to quote, he says, real estate is a conversation, and that's really all it is. I mean, if something fits, then it works. It's not an impulse item.
One of the tricky things about developing this island, it's in three counties, mostly in Contra Costa, but also San Francisco and Marin counties. Want to build something here? Think public hearings, codes, concerned citizens, and environmental regulations. Still, when Dave Glickman talks about his little Red Rock Island, he stresses the potential for development and profit. Baykeeper's executive director, Deb Self, has a different vision.
I hope that whoever buys it is willing to keep it in its natural state. That would be ideal. And the less human contact, the better off for the inhabitants of the island right now.
Red Rock Island isn't quite on the market yet. Higby and Glickman are still working out the details. Meanwhile, you'll find photos of our great adventure on our website. It's californiareport.org. Water is a highly regulated commodity in California, as it should be. You want to be sure what's coming out of your faucet is clean and safe. But once you use tap water for things like dishes and laundry, it typically goes down the drain and out into the sewer. And some people see that as a lot of unnecessarily wasted water. Now, a growing movement of do-it-yourself eco-plumbers are testing the limits of just how far you can go to recapture that water before running into trouble with the law. Amy Standen reports.
Back here, it's a bit hard to see. You have to lean in. It's that red handle over there.
Mateo, whose last name we aren't using for reasons that will soon become clear, is pointing to a small valve behind the clothes washer of his Oakland home. If you turn it to one side, the wastewater from a load of laundry flows where it normally would, to the wastewater treatment plant at the East Bay Municipal Utility District, or EBMUD.
If you turn it to the other side, the water goes into what ends up being like a humongous bucket, if you will, in our garden.
That bucket sits on a table just outside the house. It contains water that's gray with things like soap and dirt and oils.
And we've got a hose connected to it that we can just turn on and off.
Mateo carries the hose over to a planter box filled with tomatoes and other vegetables. He sticks the nozzle into the mouth of a thick white PVC pipe that pokes out from the dirt. Water trickles down through the pipe and into the root system of the plants. This way, the recycled water never comes into contact with the edible parts of the plants. It's also an efficient way to irrigate.
So rather than the water being immediately exposed to the sun and possibly evaporating, it's going under. So it's a, you know, smarter use of water.
The system may seem intuitive, but it's also illegal, built without a permit from the city. Instead, Mateo recruited a group called the Gray Water Gorillas, which helps people set up simple gray water recycling systems like this one. Laura Allen is one of the group's founders.
Gray water is water that comes out of sinks, showers, washing machines. It's any water that has not come in contact with toilet water, which is called black water.
Allen says that gray water is perfectly safe to be used on plants as long as you follow a few simple rules. Minimize contact with the gray water, don't let it accumulate in standing pools, and use ecological soaps that won't kill plants.
Doesn't make a lot of sense to have to pay a lot of fees and spend days to try to get the right permits to just detach your sink and send it outside to water your plants. So you don't want to drink gray water, definitely, but it's not that dirty, and your plants love it.
But from the perspective of city government, gray water recycling is a potential public health disaster. Managed improperly, it could spread human diseases like E. coli. Pools of stagnant gray water can attract mosquitoes, vectors for West Nile virus. So getting a permit for something like this can be a sea of red tape, and as a result, not many people do it. In the East Bay, one of the few permitted gray water recycling systems is here on a tree-lined street in North Berkeley. Berkeley's Eco House is kind of like an exhibit home for green living. Its large garden is home to both a resident duck as well as an elaborate and legal gray water recycling system.
So the system is over here. We have a pipe just exiting the house.
John Russell is a licensed landscape contractor. He points to where that pipe enters a gravel pit that's planted with papyrus and other water-loving plants.
And then as the water flows through the gravel to the other end, all the particulate matter and all the bits of hair and lint that are common in gray water get filtered out. And by the time it gets through the wetland, you have nice, clean, pure water flowing out the end of it that you can use to irrigate your landscape with.
Russell crouches down and digs a few inches until a little pool of gray water wells up from the gravel.
The water level in these constructed wetlands is always kept below the surface of the gravel so you don't have any problems with mosquitoes or anything like that. You never have any standing water in the system.
The technology is simple, but it wasn't cheap. Using all volunteer labor, the Eco House spent about $4,000 on this system, including a pump which sends the filtered water out into the garden. Compare that to the less than $100 that Mateo spent on his house.
A lot of that is from the permitting fees. And right now, there haven't been a lot of permitted systems done in this area. So when the plumbing department gets a set of plans, they can be a little skeptical as far as gray water because they've never really seen these types of systems before.
And therein lies the catch-22. Until city building departments get more requests for permitted systems, there's little pressure on them to make it easier. But until they make it easier, there's little incentive for citizens to do it by the book. Back in Oakland, the reward is in the water bills. Mateo says he's using half the water he used a year ago, while his garden has doubled in size. Encouraged by his success, he's now recycling gray water from a bathroom sink and shower as well. The biggest surprise, he says, is how easy it's been.
The system is a lot simpler than I expected it to be. Anybody with the proper assistance of somebody who's done it before, I think, can do it in half a day.
Mateo and others could face steep fines if they get caught, but there are other reasons to do it by the book as well. EBMUD offers a small rebate to customers who recycle their gray water, that is, if they do it legally. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
To see photos from this story, visit our website, you got it, www.californiareport.org. A shortage of water is looming in several parts of California. Two counties have started mandatory water rationing in fear we might be heading for a prolonged drought. Reporter Ed Joyce covers environmental issues for KPBS Radio in San Diego, where water conservation is voluntary, at least for the time being.
We're coming off of the third driest rain year on record in San Diego County. This follows what was the third wettest year. So the good news is that the reservoirs are full and we're drawing that water down now in this dry period. The bad news is water agencies want us to conserve as much of that water as possible because going forward, there could be another dry year.
What are water officials in San Diego telling consumers?
They're telling us to conserve about 20 gallons a day voluntarily right now. And really to reduce the outdoor watering. A lot of water is wasted on watering lawns. Maybe people water the lawn twice as much as they need to. And so they're asking people to voluntarily conserve water at this point.
Right now it's voluntary, but we've got mandatory rationing in other parts of the state, Sonoma County, Santa Cruz County. If that were to come to San Diego County, what impact would it have there?
I think predominantly the agriculture interests would be hard-pressed. There's a two-tiered water supply plan for the agriculture interests, predominantly in San Diego County. Avocados and nursery farmers would be hurt. There are some farmers that pay up a higher level for their water rate to ensure a steady supply, but there are many farmers that pay sort of a reduced rate, but they're first in line when there's any mandatory cutbacks. If there are mandatory cutbacks, avocado and nursery farmers would probably plant less crops because they'd have less water to use.
The governor has been traveling around the state. Last week he was in Riverside County where he declared a state of emergency over the drought. This week he's been pressuring the legislature with speeches around the state. He wants them to pass a $6 billion water bond to rebuild the state's water system. Is there a sense he might be crying wolf in order to get this thing passed through the legislature?
He's probably picked a good time to come out with touting this plan. I think everything has sort of played into showing that there is a need, depending upon what you feel that need is, for additional storage of water. Now, whether that means new reservoirs, as the governor is proposing, or expanding existing reservoirs, that's a bone of contention. Between the dry year and the Colorado River, the Delta problems, and the continued dry conditions and the low snowpack, the timing is right to tout this plan. However, I should point out that voters in California just in November passed a $6 billion bond package, or $5.4 billion to be exact, and the legislature and the governor have yet to parcel out how that money is going to be allocated to buff up the water supply system in the state.
Well, no one can predict the weather at least more than a day or two or three ahead of time. But other than rainfall, Ed, what are some of the other variables that could affect this issue in the coming months?
Water agencies and other officials are really concerned about next year. There's a perfect storm of sorts percolating. Combined with a dry year this year in many parts of the state, the Sierra snowpack being 29% of normal, the Colorado River Basin is in the midst of an eight-year drought. Southern California gets about 20% or more of its water from that source. Add to that predictions that global climate change from greenhouse gas emissions could lower California's snowpack going forward from anywhere from 30 to 70% and population growth. Those are a lot of bullet points that say there's a real crisis when the state relies predominantly on Mother Nature and imported water for its resource.
And one thing you can say for sure is that demand for water is not going to be going down anytime soon. Ed Joyce covers environmental issues for KPBS Radio in San Diego. Ed, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
Last week would have been saxophonist John Coltrane's 80th birthday. The enduring power and beauty of his music is explored in a recent album by the San Francisco Bay Area's Turtle Island Quartet. Jazz critic Andrew Gilbert has this review.
In the modern jazz pantheon, no album ranks higher than John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. Recorded in 1964 by his classic quartet with pianist McCoy Tyner, bassist Jimmy Garrison, and drummer Elvin Jones, the spiritually charged four-part suite expresses the irrepressible human desire for communion with the divine. A Love Supreme is so imposing that few have attempted to perform it in its entirety. Coltrane himself is only known to have played it once in public. In other words, it's exactly the kind of challenge that has proven irresistible for Turtle Island, a pioneering jazz string quartet. Founded in the mid-1980s, the Bay Area group has ranged widely across the musical landscape. They've embraced Cuban music with Paquito de Rivera, and last year won a Grammy for their crossover classical collaboration 4 Plus 4. With A Love Supreme, the legacy of John Coltrane, Turtle Island delves back into its jazz roots. The album's 13 tracks all explore music composed by, associated with, or inspired by Coltrane, who died in 1967 at the age of 40. Opening with cellist Mark Summers' arrangement of the saxophonist's harmonically dense sing-song theme Moment's Notice, the group displays its finely honed rhythmic agility. Danish-born violist Mads Tolling, the quartet's newest member, is responsible for the translucent version of Coltrane's ballad Naima, a piece perfectly suited for string interpretation. The album's centerpiece is violinist David Balakrishnan's ingenious interpretation of A Love Supreme. He arranged the final three movements like regular jazz numbers, leaving lots of space for the musicians to improvise on Coltrane's themes. But with the first movement, Acknowledgement, he transcribed the saxophonist's improvisation and turned it into a through-composed piece, highlighting the intricate structure of Coltrane's solo. Even if you're not familiar with the original recording, it's difficult to avoid getting swept along by the insistent refrain. By the end of the album, there are no lingering doubts about the wisdom of a string quartet tackling Coltrane's music. But then, Turtle Island has a brilliant track record of reinterpreting jazz standards. In this case, the saxophonist's widow, pianist Alice Coltrane, gave the project her stamp of approval shortly before she passed away last January, writing that she hopes listeners everywhere will be receptive to these musicians' sublime and beautiful art.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed A Love Supreme, The Legacy of John Coltrane by Turtle Island Quartet. And finally today, change is an essential part of California culture. We always seem to be reinventing ourselves. But in this age of constant transition, at least one small business in San Jose is still doing things the old-fashioned way. On a hot Saturday morning recently, Jackson Street in San Jose's Japantown was quiet, except for the dozens of people lined up in front of the San Jose Tofu Company. Many of them carry Tupperware containers as they file into this tiny two-room shop, looking to take home a few blocks of fresh, handmade tofu. Amy Nozaki takes orders from her customers. Her husband Chester stands nearby in an apron and worn rubber boots next to a dripping stack of wooden tofu molds. The Nozakis took over the family business about 7 years ago. As a kid, Chester Nozaki would help out in the shop when he could. He remembers summers making deliveries around Japantown.
We always had a radio flyer wagon, and my dad would put the tofu in the container, and they'd put the container on the wagon and say, go deliver to so-and-so. And okay, so just pull the wagon down the street and go, here's your tofu.
Nothing here is automated. It's all done by hand, just like it was when the shop opened after World War II. Nozaki's father insisted that a hands-on approach was essential to preserving the quality of the tofu.
His thoughts are still trapped in my head, and I just pretty much adapted that to keep it the old-fashioned way. Plus, my customers prefer it this way, too. They like to see it actually made rather than seeing a machine doing the whole work.
Although it's nearly 90 degrees on the street, it's refreshingly cool inside. The constant flow of water circulating through the large tofu vats takes the heat off naturally. Nozaki steps aside and picks up a bucket of soybeans.
These are the soybeans. They're dehydrated. We wash these and we soak these overnight. And these beans, they absorb the water and they kind of expand. They're soft.
The process is simple. The beans are ground up after they've been soaked, then put into a cauldron of boiling water. The mix is then poured into a filter that's pressed and drained. The curd that remains is poured into a wooden box lined in cheesecloth and dunked into a tub of cool water, where it's later sliced up into blocks. Amy Nozaki fishes out a handful of snowy white mounds of tofu. Almost nothing goes to waste when making tofu. Nozaki beams over a barrel of steaming okara. These are the ground beans after they've been soaked, and they happen to make a tasty little treat. And the milk that's pressed from the curd, it's also sold in gallon jugs. Although it's gradually made its way to the California palate, tofu has, for centuries, been a staple of the Asian diet.
My guess is that it's because it's like a health food to Westerners, where to Asians, it's like the Asian steak and potatoes.
The San Jose Tofu Company has been a mainstay here in Japantown for decades, but the neighborhood isn't the same one Nozaki knew as a boy.
It's not like it was in the 60s or in the 70s, where this was basically like Japantown, and really not too many people spoke English. It's changed. But, you know, you come in here and it's like nothing's changed. But, like I say, a lot of customers say, don't do anything, leave it alone.
And Nozaki says he's just as happy to oblige.
You have a good weekend.
And that's our show for this week. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Tom Krimkowski and Howard Gelman. Our interns are Danny Vernon, Katie Stanford, and Lita Martinez. She produced our visit to the San Jose Tofu Company. The producers are Victoria Malione and Erica Kelly. Our editors are Kat Snow and Pat Flynn. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have yourself a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, OSH Complete Home and Garden, offering service and selection to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.